KQED.
Hey there, everybody. From KQED's politics team, I'm Scott Schaefer, and this is Political Breakdown.
I'm Marisa Lagos. Thank you for tuning in tonight. As always, we've got a ton to go over.
Later on, Democratic donor and political disruptor Tom Steyer joins us.
But first, we're going to spend a few minutes unpacking Governor Jerry Brown's 16th and final State of the State speech this morning. That's right, I said 16th. And the governor gave himself some high remarks after he delivered the 30-minute speech.
Well, it feels good with all that applause, I can tell you.
Yeah, it always feels good when they're clapping. You know, it's funny, when he first came out this morning to give the speech, his first line was, "I accept your nomination."
Yes.
And then he says, "Who knows?"
To a lot of laughter. And I was joking earlier, I think we all know what his wife, Ann Gus Brown, would say, which is, we're going to the ranch.
You're not running for president.
That's right.
Exactly.
Yeah, Scott, you were here in San Francisco watching. So you got to see the First Lady, apparently. I couldn't see her from where I was sitting in the Capitol.
She was very excited up in the balcony. Applauding louder for her husband than just about anybody. She's wearing a fabulous dress. I just have to say that.
I know. I want to see it now.
Yeah, it was really good. But she's clearly, I mean, I think both of them are feeling good. They're feeling proud of where the state has come under his, you know, 8 years in, or seven, soon to be eight in Sacramento. And, you know, I think they're also excited about retiring, I would say. But before that, you know, he did make a little bit of news, Marisa. We know that the governor is a prolific fundraiser. And actually, you know, before you do that.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more broadly about the speech, because I think it's important to note, you know, this was interesting, as Scott, you know, since we do these specials every year during it. It was a longer speech than we're used
30
to.
30 minutes, yeah.
Around 30 minutes, which is, you know, full 10 minutes longer, I think, than last year.
And he was right on time. I mean, he came in at 10:01.
Totally. I was like, oh, he's here already. And it was upbeat. You know, I think he got a really welcome sort of applause in the chambers. Obviously, majority Democrats in there, but the Republicans were standing for some of it too. And it was sort of a victory lap. He opened with a really sort of positive overall message.
Simply put, California is prospering. While it faces its share of difficulties, we should never forget the bounty and the endless opportunities bestowed on this special place, or the distance we've all traveled these last few years.
And, you know, that's, of course, referring to the fact that when he came in office, we were in the depths of the recession, the foreclosure crisis. There was a $27 billion deficit.
That's a big deficit.
And now it's a $7 billion surplus. And so, you know, I think, like you said, I think in some ways the governor is really trying to talk about what he feels like he's accomplished and protect some of those accomplishments.
Absolutely. And I think he's probably a little concerned that, he's been saying the sky is falling with the economy for 4 years, and eventually it'll be true. But I think he's concerned that, you know, it may happen on the next governor's watch, and I think he's a little concerned about how they're going to handle that. And he also made a little bit of news today. You know, the governor, as the governors do, has raised a fair amount of money over the years, and he hasn't spent it. He's got about $15 million in the bank, and everybody's been wondering, well, how's he going to spend it?
Got a little idea today.
And we should just say that it has to do with the gas tax, which was a big accomplishment in the last session.
Fighting a gas tax may appear to be good politics, but it isn't. I will do everything in my power to defeat any repeal effort that gets on the ballot.
And in fact, there were two repeal efforts. One of them has failed, but the two leading Republicans running for governor, John Cox and Travis Allen, are both pushing a repeal. I think the Republicans think that's a big way to get their vote out, to get people to come out and vote to repeal the gas tax. But he said, you know, you try it, it's kind of over my dead body. I'm going to throw a lot of money at it.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting, because we have all sort of been, you know, wondering if and when the governor might spend all that money. And, you know, more broadly, I think he spent it defending not just the gas tax, but a broad range of the initiatives that he's, you know, really championed in the last few years, including criminal justice reforms. He asked lawmakers whether they could, you know, think a little bit more before they start rolling back some of the things that he's helped to do to really, you know, ease the crowding in the prison.
And yeah, exactly. I mean, criminal justice reform, definitely a big part of his legacy. And, you know, people were wondering, is he going to say anything about the high-speed rail? You know, is he going to say anything about the Delta tunnels? Those are two big infrastructure projects that are both in their own way a little bit troubled, shall we say.
A little bit, yeah.
High-speed rail, a little bit over budget, the tunnels not happening so much. But this is what he had to say about those things.
Like any big project, there are obstacles. There were for the Bay Area Rapid Transit System, for the Golden Gate Bridge, and the Panama Canal. I'll pass over in silence the time it took to build the Bay Area Bridge. That was almost 20 years. And by the way, it was over budget by $6 billion on a $1 billion project. So that happens. But not with the high-speed rail. We got that one covered.
Well, I don't know about
maybe
that.
Not. Yeah. Yeah.
The big problem there, of course, is there's no federal money yet.
Right. And there have been cost overruns, and I think there's a lot of question about what the next governor might do. But, you know, I think generally you heard the laughter in that. There was a lot of light moments, and he seemed to have a good time. After the speech was over, he spent like 15 minutes in the chamber shaking hands with lawmakers.
Which he doesn't usually do.
He doesn't. And actually, it caused a little kerfuffle on the floor because the security folks didn't know what to do about us reporters with the governor still there.
Yeah. So savoring. He's probably going to be savoring these last few months, I would think, and a little indication of that. And it's going to be fun to follow how he goes out. We talked to him a couple of weeks ago. He told us he was making olive oil
right
on the ranch. So he's kind of easing into retirement, I'd say.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting. He definitely isn't putting forward any huge new initiatives, although he did talk about this proposal to have an online community college for the first time. But yeah, I think a lot of this year is going to be about protecting and sort of trying to, you know, promote his legacy, even though he hates that word.
Hates that word, yeah. All right, well, we're going to make a little transition here. We've got Tom Steyer in the house with us, and we'll get back to him. We're going to come to him in a moment. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio.
Hey, everyone. We are going to widen our focus a bit now. You know, if you don't follow politics, you may not be familiar with our next guest, but you might have seen his ads on TV in the last couple months.
I'm Tom Steyer, and like you, I'm a citizen who knows it's up to us to do something. It's why I'm funding this effort to raise our voices together and demand that elected officials take a stand on impeachment.
And joining us now in the studio, a man whose name you may or may not know. He's a former hedge fund manager, one of the biggest donors in Democratic politics, and he runs a political action committee. It's called Next Gen, as in next generation. Tom Steyer, welcome to Political Breakdown.
Great to be here.
Let's talk about that ad.
You're so serious.
Well, it's
a serious
topic. I
think
we tried to have a tone that was calm and serious because actually impeaching the president of the United States is such an important step that I think that if we're going to take it seriously, we need to give it the reverence it's due, but also make it clear that this isn't just some knee-jerk reaction, but that actually we've thought it through.
How did you – was that ad – just curious because it was a lovely setting. Was that your living room? I mean, where did you shoot that?
That's our living room.
It's your living room. And you're looking right into the camera. I mean, you only blinked once or twice.
I didn't notice.
How many times did you take that?
We took a bunch of those. I'm not a professional actor.
Did you have a teleprompter?
No.
You remembered the lines and you said them. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's had a huge impact. I mean, how many people have responded?
When we originally started, we were hoping to get 1 million people. We're at 4.4 million people, over 4.4 million people. We're actually doing next month house parties for people to talk about where we stand and to kind of reach out. And we thought we'd do 500 house parties. We announced it, I think, yesterday. We're at 5,000 house parties.
Wow. So what are they going to be doing at the house parties?
I really think the point of it is for two things. One is to keep people informed about where this stands and information and things that they can do in terms of participating, and also to reach out to their neighbors to say, maybe you should know more about this too.
So it sounds like you've really energized at least some section of the Democratic base, probably more progressive, maybe younger folks. And I know I want to talk about the millennial voter drive you're doing too. But we also have heard that it's kind of angered some mainstream Democrats. We heard House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi say that it's too soon to talk about that. I'm curious, like, does that make you more excited to do this? Is that something that you feel like energizes you?
No, I'm not trying to pick a fight with the Democratic leadership. Really, what we're trying to do is talk about an incredibly important issue straightforwardly and give a voice to the American people. I mean, one of the things, if you look at everything that we do, it's really about direct democracy and empowering citizens and voters. And so what we're trying to do here is say, no one's going to listen to me, no one would listen to the three of us. But if we have 5 million people saying we really believe this, then we believe that, that starts to be the voice of the American people saying we care about this, we're upset, you need to pay attention.
I assume you're friendly or friends with Nancy Pelosi and Dianne Feinstein. I mean, they you know, live in San Francisco. You live in San Francisco. You're a major donor to the
Nancy
party.
Nancy has been my congressperson for decades.
And so when you hear her saying, you know, it's too soon, as Marisa said, or this is going to hurt us. Not that it's too soon. This is going to energize Republicans in the fall when we don't want them to be energized. Your response is what?
My response is that what we're trying to do and what we deeply believe in is tell the truth and enable the voice of the American people to be heard. So what we're talking about is what we think is important, what we think is right, and that's what we believe in politically, is the broadest democracy and the most power for the people of the United States, and that's what we're trying to do. And we actually aren't trying to do tactical political stuff. We believe that telling the truth and standing up for what you believe in is what American democracy is all about, and we think that that's what works. So we're doing what we fervently believe in, and we're not really responsive to tactical things. We're really trying to do what we think is the most important thing we can do.
Has that changed? Because I know, you know, in 2014, I think you spent $70 million on races. Democrats did not do well that year. I mean, have you changed tactics in recent years because of that?
Well, I've been doing this full time for over 5 years. And we've kind of, there's no one else doing exactly what NextGen does. So we've kind of worked and tried different things. And we've always done what we've done, but we've done it more and more. So that when we think about 2018, we're going to be organizing as much citizen-to-citizen contact. Young people talking to each other about what are the most important issues so they can engage and participate. That's something that we've emphasized much more as we've gotten to know the political system, because partly we believe in it and partly we believe it works.
I'm curious, you know, you have put a lot of emphasis, especially lately, on millennials. You have four children, and they're of that, in that sort
Absolutely.
Of generation.
They're all four are millennials.
So to what, do you do focus groups with your kids? I mean, how do you find out what they care about?
No, I wouldn't describe my kids as guinea pigs. But what I would say is this. We know that the millennial generation is the largest age cohort in the United States, bigger than the boomers. And we know that they participate in elections at a fraction of what the rest of the electorate does. So we know that the opportunity is there. We also know it's the most diverse age cohort in the United States and the most progressive. So we believe in the broadest democracy. We want them to participate. What I know from my kids and their friends, which we also learn from focus groups, is this generation is fantastic. They're very knowledgeable. They're committed. They care. What they don't necessarily believe in is the political system. They don't necessarily believe it's responsive, that they are dealing with the real issues.
I'm just curious, you know, because that generation were the Bernie-crats, right? That's who he energized. And I don't know if you want to, you know, out your kids as Bernie-crats or not. But, you know, how do you think about that question of should the party move to the left, which is where Bernie Sanders wants to take Democrats, or should they be more diverse? Should, as Nancy Pelosi said, let's have a big tent. If there's a Democrat who can win in Missouri and they have, you know, they're maybe not pro-choice, that could be okay.
Okay, but can I rephrase that a little, Scott?
Sure.
Because from my standpoint, what I saw in 2016 was a slightly different characterization of the divide. There was a pretty rough argument between the Bernie bros and the Hillary supporters.
Right.
And I think people thought that it was sort of a traditional, moderate, progressive split.
You don't?
I actually saw it differently. So, you know, let me try this on for size and you guys can shoot me down in flames and I'll go quietly away. I thought it was more about a different way of expressing the future. I think Bernie was talking about a lot of what I would think of as visionary changes, the kind of thing if we're going to have, you know,
single payer.
Yeah, single payer, or we're going to have free college tuition or what have you. But they weren't, you know, bold,
aspirational
goals. And Mrs. Clinton was talking so much more about incremental, practical, realistic change.
Hard to get excited about that.
That's one huge difference. And then I think the second question is Bernie was talking directly and indirectly about corruption in the system. You know, he was talking about that there's too much money in the system. These corporations are unfair. And so and the huge divide between rich and poor. And so I think that that's actually those two things, not policies so much as a way of expressing those two points.
Couldn't you say sort of the same thing about Trump on the other side of the political spectrum? He talked about the wall. He talked about some very, you know, America first, you know, things that were easily understood. Now, many people would say they're very misguided and not even practical. And, you know, Mexico is not going to pay for that wall. But is that what you're saying, that maybe you need to have things that are easily understood that will mobilize people, even if they're not really doable?
Well, I would say when I think about Trump, I think he actually did do something. He's very good at something. He got elected president without knowing anything.
Marketing.
I wouldn't say that. He's very good at listening to what other people think. His response, in my mind, is racist, belligerent, magical, and counterproductive. So I absolutely disagree with virtually everything that he's proposed and every person he suggested. But when he talks about the wall, it's a magical solution to a non-problem that is incredibly racist and unfair, but it is dealing with the anxiety of some a slug of the people in our society. And the anxiety is real. It's just the solution is so unfair, so unrealistic, and so wrong.
So you're talking about all this, and you talked about Bernie and the sort of, you know, the wealth between the rich and the poor. Obviously, you're very wealthy. You're using that money for this. But I just wonder, this is similar to a conversation, I think, that's happening in San Francisco that's been going on about the mayor's race and how, you know, the sense that wealthy tech billionaires are trying to sort of like steer politics. And I'm just curious, like what, like when you hear that, what you think as somebody who could be lumped in with that?
I actually am very sympathetic to the people who worry about losing the soul of San Francisco. Because in my mind, any city, including the city that I live in and that I love, gets a soul from having a diverse group of people, diverse in background, and from every kind of income level. And so I worry about the gentrification of San Francisco. I think anyone who loves the city has to worry about that. And I worry in particular about the fairness of people who are forced to leave the city that they grew up in, that they live in, because they can no longer afford to live here. So when I do think that as in most – there's no such thing as a free market. People love to talk about free markets. I think that is a myth. The fact of the matter is every single market in the world, including the housing market in San Francisco, has rules. And so if you think about the most basic market, if the three of us were going to the vegetable market in, you know, 1,000 years ago, there'd be a place where it was designated to be. There'd be a time that was open. And formally or informally, people would decide where they set up their stalls. There are always rules. So sure, I worry about the soul of San Francisco, and I think we all should.
Do you think, I mean, obviously tech, there's a big conversation now about the impact of tech in San Francisco and the Bay Area. The name Ron Conway, who most people probably don't know, but that was batted around. He's an angel investor who was very much embraced. He embraced Ed Lee and London Breed and so on. I assume you know him, right?
I know George.
Yeah. I mean, what do you think about that sort of singling out a person for, you know, not want to say vilification, but somebody who's been throwing his weight around, somebody who's been, you know, trying to pressure people? I mean, is that just politics or is it, do you have to play the game differently in San Francisco?
I don't know exactly what Ron's done. And I'm actually I'm not really very involved in this, in the day-to-day politics of the city that I live in. I will say this, what we like to do and what we believe in doing is not doing that, which is going to politicians and trying to solicit them or lobby them. What we believe in doing is going to the voters, going directly to the voters, talking, setting up programs or in some way, shape or form dealing with them directly so that they can be heard. And actually, that's what I believe in, is that if I thought something were wrong in the city of San Francisco, then I would want to see if I could set up a program to go around to the different neighborhoods to say, hey, have you thought that this might be in all of our interests? And if you agree, can we please put our voices together? Because it's not – I don't want to do it myself, but I think if everybody in all the neighborhoods agrees that we need this, then let's do it together and let's ask for it together.
Well, you say that, but I also noticed this week that you said you would not want to be donating anymore to the Democratic Party because of their decision to reopen the government, and I assume what you would see as sort of cave on this DACA deal. I mean, isn't that sort of an attempt to pressure these Democrats?
Actually, no, I wouldn't say so, because I think what we're going to do and what we've always done is really these direct grassroots programs. And so I think what we're saying is we're going to go – I think we're going to – if anything, I'm giving away any ability I ever had to do that. The fact of the matter is I'm saying I'm going to go directly and try and link up with voters. We're going to do grassroots programs. We're going to sign up petitions. But if I wanted to have – power with the national committees, then the best thing I could do is give money and call them on the phone and say, you know, don't you
do
remember
this for
me?
That.
I'm the guy whose name is on that check. Actually, what I'm saying is we want to stand with the people and we want the people's voice.
You've been called the Democratic version of the Koch brothers, you know, somebody who's spending a lot of money on the things you care about, as they are. What do you think when you hear that? You laughed, but I mean, is...
Well, I don't like the Koch brothers at all. So I think that to be compared to them is something that obviously my initial reaction is to try and find as many ways that I'm different from them as I possibly can. So let's start with the fact that I think that money in politics is corrupting, and I think there should be reform of the way campaigns are financed. I'm against Citizens United. I think that was a terrible decision. I also accept the fact that the rules in our democracy are the rules in our democracy. So in what we do, we're trying to lead to the broadest democracy. We try and be totally transparent. As I always say when I'm being interviewed, I'd like to hear your interview with the Koch brothers and see how it went, because they are absolutely not transparent. And I also believe that what we are doing is exactly what I said we were doing, which is trying to stand up for the interests, the common interests of voters, and particularly of the vast preponderance of voters. So it's very hard I would argue impossible to say that what I'm doing is to try and help myself personally. The fact of the matter is what we stand up for is what we believe is the principled position, and they are clearly acting on behalf of their bottom line.
So what is it that made you decide to, you said you've been doing this full time for 5 years. Was there a moment? I mean, why now and why you?
When did the LiPo go off?
Well, let me say this. I actually think this is the greatest opportunity for me, but also for every American to contribute in their own way. And that's this. Look, I think we're in a fight for the soul of the United States of America. And so if you get a chance in your life to participate on the side of right and go against what you believe to be morally, ethically wrong in a really important way that threatens people who you love and also threatens the institutions, the democratic institutions that I'm sure all three of us were brought up to revere and hold dear, if you get a chance to be in that fight, I don't view that as like a hardship. I view that as like, that is such a great chance, because that's what Americans have done for hundreds of years and been incredibly happy to do and proud of doing.
There's been a lot of speculation about your future in politics. People thought you might jump into the governor's race or the Senate race. Somebody who I think is loosely affiliated with you has the TomStyerForPresident.com.
No way.
Yes. Oh, come on.
There's
you
websites.
Didn't know about that?
You have so, there's so
no.
many Tom
yes.
Steyer websites. Yeah.
No, there is not.
TomStyerForGovernor.org. Check it out.
Clearly, I didn't set that up.
So,
that's hilarious.
So, but you know, are you hesitant to get in? Is it something you thought about? I mean, because there's so much speculation.
Scott, this what I've said consistently, and I thought I'd just proved it a month ago when I said I wasn't running for anything in 2018.
Right. What about 2020?
What I've said about 2018, which is what I said in 2017, and what I'm saying now is, look, I am unabashedly ambitious to try and be on the side of right and to be one of the people, hopefully millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of Americans who are standing up for our deepest ideals and making a difference. And I want to. And I'm not shy about it. I'm absolutely intent on trying to be effective on that side along with millions of other Americans. I am. In my opinion, this year is a pivotal year. I've said we are all in through November 6, 2018, and none of us knows where we're going to be on November 7, 2018, but it's going to be dramatically different from where we are now, one way or the other.
You think Trump will be impeached?
Do I think he'll be impeached in what time frame?
Yeah, before 2020 ever? Is over.
I do. Actually, you know, the funny thing is, I think that he has committed the high crimes and misdemeanors, which really means he's broken faith with the Constitution and the American people. I think it's very clear. I think it's a political question and that it's in the hands. I know how the rules work, that it's about being impeached by the House and convicted by the Senate. I know they're high standards to meet. But I believe this is actually in the hands and the minds and the hearts of the American people. And I think that if we go through the process, which we're in the process, which we're in the midst of educating the American people about what he's done and the threat he poses to our safety and to our democracy, that the American people will go. And it doesn't, this is not a partisan issue because it can't be a partisan issue. I believe they will do what my parents said in 1974, which is, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me?
Were your parents Republican?
No. Yes.
Wow.
My parents quit the Republican Party.
They turned on Nixon.
Because they said, the president lied to us. The president lied to the American people. And we all watched the Watergate hearings on TV. And my parents were like babes in the woods.
But Trump, you know, lies all the time.
And if my parents were here, they would be outraged.
Yeah, but Democrats, the Republicans so far are sticking with them, by and large. By and
large. All I can say is I'm not worried about the Republican elected officials. What I think matters, and this is my whole point, it's the human beings, it's the voters, it's the American citizens, whether they be Republicans or Democrats. And when the people of America see what I believe this guy's done and the threat he poses to all of us and our traditions and our values, they're going to go, no. Gotta go.
All right.
All right. You heard it here.
Well, hey, Tom Steyer, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me. You guys told me.
It's really interesting. Did you have fun?
Oh, my God. You guys are saying, why are you doing this? Why are you going through this pain? For what job? I love doing this. Are you kidding me?
All right. That does it for this edition of Political Breakdown. Make sure you don't miss an episode. Go ahead and subscribe to the podcast. You can find it on iTunes.
You can also get it on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast. Our producer is Guy Marzorati. Our engineer is Seal Muller. Ethan Lindsay is our managing editor. And Holly Kernan is the vice president of news.
I'm Scott Schaefer. You can follow me on Twitter. It's at Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. I'm at M. Lagos.
That is a wrap for this week's Political Breakdown from KQED. We'll see you next time.